On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I basically went to all the people that didn't fund Weekend, and I said, you know, you didn't fund my last film. Do you want to fund this film? And they were like, look, we're sorry we said no last time, so yes, we'll put you in development.
The surprise success of director Andrew Haig's first film, Weekend, made funding his next one much easier. His new movie, 45 Years, about a sudden turn in a marriage of that duration, has actress Charlotte Rampling in awards contention. Haig tells us about savoring the success of 45 Years while facing the cancellation of his HBO show, Looking. But first on the News Banter, 2015 is officially in the books. What lies ahead? Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterers, two fellow banterers, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine and Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
So, the future is what we're going to talk about today. The future, the year to come. We don't quite have a crystal ball, but we're going to do our best. One of the stories we want to look ahead to, of course, is Viacom. Michael Wolff, the columnist, recently wrote an essay in The Hollywood Reporter boldly predicting that the 92-year-old and very frail head of this company, Viacom and CBS, the executive chairman, will die in the year ahead. I would say that's not a crazy bet. The man, as far as we know, has been on a feeding tube for more than a year now, which I think is somewhat unusual. And there is a battle already underway. Who is going to control these two companies when finally Sumner Redstone, who once repeatedly vowed that he would never die, actually does die?
Yeah, the question is how Sumner Redstone has set up his trust to dispose of or to manage these two companies. Because what we know is that there is a 7-member board of trustees that will have input on this trust, and the trust is for the benefit of Redstone's grandchildren. But what we don't know is what the imperative is of these trustees. Are they going to sell off companies or assets? Are they going to invest in different businesses and try to diversify out of just a pure media business play? There are a lot of big questions that are sort of swirling around CBS and Viacom that won't be answered until this one thing happens.
And one of the questions is who controls this trust? And Redstone's daughter, Shari, with whom he has sometimes feuded and seems to be sort of back in the inner circle, could in fact control that trust or not. And it's just a muddle. But of course, I'll just quickly say the fate of properties like not just CBS, but MTV, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, and Paramount Pictures, all of them are caught up in the future. And certainly Viacom has performed very poorly. CBS under Leslie Moonves has performed quite well in this environment.
Yeah, and one thing to add to that, you know, Moonves has said over and over again now he does not foresee Viacom and CBS re-merging like they once were. It just wouldn't make sense at this point. He doesn't want it. And if anything, it would drag down his sort of small, tight company that he's got.
Well, you know, but he is also a hungry man. He always has been. So who knows the potential complexity of what could happen with this company and what could be spun out or sold or merged. It makes my head spin. I'm a little bit afraid of trying to cover it in the months ahead. One player who could emerge in all of this is John Malone. He is a very eccentric guy. He is quite a power broker in the past. He sort of somewhat was off the radar for a number of years, seemed to be fed up with investing in media and very anti-paying taxes for any transactions, so he didn't seem to be doing that much. But he has pieces of Discovery, a piece of Lionsgate, the studio behind Hunger Games and Twilight. He has cable assets, and there are people who think that he will be a mover and shaker again in the year ahead and potentially buying some or all of Viacom. Who knows?
Yeah, one scenario has Viacom going to John Malone because there would be some synergistic aspects of that and some tax benefits, adding cable networks to what he already has, and maybe even using Lionsgate as part of that, or taking all of these cable assets and putting them together with Lionsgate to create this, you know, sort of bigger media opus. That's one scenario. The other is that CBS in this scenario could just be spun off on its own, either for CBS's Leslie Moonves to run himself or to bring in different investors to partner with. But I think that Malone could play a big role in both of these scenarios.
But I love, you know, the timing of it, of course, as we've all got Star Wars on the brain. John Malone, of course, famously Darth Vader in the 80s and 90s, once again reemerging the dark.
Well, I think my fear is certainly justified, because if there is anyone who worships a complex, incomprehensible deal, it is John Malone, and he's fully capable of executing those. Let's just turn also quickly to a couple of other topics. Relativity in bankruptcy, Ryan Kavanaugh's company. He claimed to have solved the puzzle of trying to make hit movies. Turns out he hadn't, ended up in a pretty spectacular bankruptcy. Who knows what's left?
Yeah, the question I think for 2016 is going to be, can Ryan Kavanaugh reestablish control of this company out of bankruptcy, which he has stated is his goal? And secondly, if he does establish control of this company, who in the world is going to want to work with him, both as employees for the company or potential partners to take on movie projects?
Yeah, it is really baffling to me that people wanted to work with him in the past, so I'm not quite sure how people will now work with him with the exposure of how much money that company had been losing. So we've talked about in the past at length, you know, about the changing environment in the entertainment business. And I think all of us believe, at least certainly I do, that the herd will have to thin. There are a lot of companies spewing out a lot of content. I would have not thought that Warner Brothers, and the film studio certainly, and the television studio, you know, with huge hits and a legacy of success, you know, always one of the top studios in the business, the Tiffany of these studios, would be on a list to be disposed of. But Time Warner, the studio, is performing, certainly on the film side, very, very poorly. Jeff Bukas changed up management maybe 3 years ago. It has not gone well so far. It's gone very not well. The environment is tougher for the Warner Brothers TV studio, since they do not have a major network like Disney does, could feed things to ABC or Fox. So it seems to me that Time Warner could also be in play, and Warner Brothers could end up, you know, who knows where, being sold to someone else and no longer being this. I think that will actually sadden this cold-hearted industry to see Warner Brothers in this kind of distress.
Fox famously went after Time Warner last year, and it didn't work out. And James and Lachlan Murdoch, who are now running 21st Century Fox, say they have no interest. They've moved on. So I think that that potential buyer may be out of the picture, but there could be buyers for particular assets. 2016 is going to be a key year for the Warner Brothers film studio. Kevin Tsujihara, the CEO of the studio, has said that, yes, we've had a bunch of flops in 2015, but just wait until next year. That's when the strategy kicks in. And he has built his entire strategy around movies from the DC Entertainment Division, which begin in
Batman versus Superman.
Yes,
will be the
March. Batman versus Superman is the first of those. And then in November, they're releasing the first of the Harry Potter prequels, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. That is the other element of his whole plan, where if they can successfully restart both the Batman and Harry Potter franchises, those are potentially $2 billion grossers per year that they will have for years to come. And there's a whole slate, especially of DC films, that they are trying to do to emulate the Marvel Universe. And if Warners can pull that off, I think we'll be telling a very different story next year.
Yeah, and on the television side, I mean, who knows? We've played around with different scenarios for years. For the longest time, it looked like a Warner's CBS merger would make the most sense, just because they're already in business on so many different things, including the CW TV network. But again, you know, who knows? It'll be an interesting year to keep an eye on.
I will just make one last point, which is many people have said to me, when Rupert Murdoch, who's very much still in the picture at Fox, has offered for a company in the past, he has never given up. So just something to bear in mind. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter and Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine.
They ask me how I knew.
The film 45 Years tells the story of British couple Jeff and Kate, played by Tom Courtney and Charlotte Rampling, in the week leading up to their 45th wedding anniversary. They're a contented pair living quietly in retirement in the English countryside, at least until Jeff receives a startling piece of news. The body of his one-time fiancé, who died decades earlier while the two were hiking in Switzerland, has been discovered perfectly preserved in ice. For Kate, this leads to unexpected revelations about her spouse of many years.
I was her next of kin.
What do you mean?
Officially, I was her next of kin. I'm sure I told you this before.
But I think I remember her husband being another woman's next of kin. Why?
Why what?
Well, why were you her next of kin?
Because they thought we were married.
Who did?
The authorities, people.
What made them think that?
We told them we were.
Charlotte Rampling has been acting for more than 50 years, but has never been nominated for an Oscar. This film could change that. The Los Angeles and Boston film critics both have named her Best Actress. The director of 45 Years is Andrew Haig, a British filmmaker who debuted in 2011 with Weekend, a micro-budgeted character-based drama that follows a brief romantic encounter between two men. Weekend was an indie hit, and opportunity followed. Haig got a call from HBO, which wanted him to produce Looking, a series that follows the lives of several gay men questing for happiness in San Francisco. 45 Years is only his second feature. After leaving college 2 decades ago, Haig started working as a crew member on big-budget movies like Gladiator and Black Hawk Down, a far cry from the kind of delicate interior drama of 45 Years.
I studied history at university. I didn't study film. And then I left university knowing I wanted to make films. But of course, you need to like live and work. And so you can't just like suddenly think, oh, I'm just going to go make movies. I didn't feel like I could. So I just started working my way up in the industry. I did a bunch of like PAing jobs. And then I kind of essentially fell into being an assistant editor. And a lot of those ended up being on like big films when they came to England, kind of big like Hollywood movies. And then I did that for like a bunch of years, really, for probably about 10 years, and always wanted to be a director, but thought, you know, I've got to just, how's this going to happen? And then just found a way to do it myself.
You went to film school.
I went and did a 1-year course out in LA, actually.
You're talking about the LA Film School. And so anybody who works there or is associated with it should cover their ears, but you called it not particularly prestigious.
I would say that even they would probably agree that it probably wasn't like the most prestigious course in the world.
Right.
But it was only for a year, which was good for me.
It's like, did you just save your pence?
Yeah, I'd saved my money, came over here, did the course. But it just means that every single day you're thinking about film, working on other people's short films, making your own short films. And that was like really kind of liberating.
So coming out of this LA film school, you're ready to wave your wand and say, I am a director.
Yes.
And how do you do that?
So I went back home and then wasn't a director, obviously. I hadn't couldn't make a film. And then I made a film called Weekend, which happened probably 2 years after I left film school, and I started getting that together, and it was a very kind of small relationship drama between these two guys set in England. And so I made that, and because that kind of opened everything up for me, because making that, it was, no one expected it to do well, and it did well for what it was. It's like a small British indie, but it came to America and was like nicely received, and people liked it. And
you have to apply for grants and the British film, whatever
so
the heck?
No one would give me any money. So it was really hard to get money for that. Everyone was like, no, I don't think we want to make a film about two gay guys talking.
Having a weekend.
Like, I don't think so.
They didn't give you money. How did you find it?
We found some, the film cost us £100,000, so
right.
$150,000.
So it's not huge, right?
It's not huge, and we found some local funding at the very last minute that was based in the city that we filmed in. And so they gave us some of the money, and there's some good tax breaks in England and all kinds of things for film. So it
became a calling card for you.
Yes, exactly.
And did that lead directly to HBO and Looking?
Yes, so they called me up and said they had this pilot script that the creator Michael Landon had written, and do you want to come over and meet us? And I was like, okay, I'll come over. I was just sitting in my house in England, and then I got on a plane the next day and came out to LA.
The next day?
Well, pretty much, like a week later something. It was really soon. Met them all at HBO, and then pretty soon after that, it was greenlit. So it was like, a transition from making a film with, you know, a crew of like 15 people to working on an HBO show with obviously much more money and a much bigger teams and all that kind of thing.
I mean, that must have been a bit daunting, really.
it's so different. And, you know, we had like a writer's room and all these things that I'd never experienced before. And I think the big thing was on the first day of the shoot, I remember turning up and like walking down the street and there were trucks everywhere. And I'm like, oh God, they're for us, all these trucks. And it was like, this is really terrifying. And I got on set and it felt intimidating. But then I just found a way to like turn it into kind of how I like it to be. So I made everything feel smaller. I put people away.
You fired half this crew.
Well, I basically hid them away from my view.
Look at me.
Yeah, it was like, I don't want Video Village anywhere near the actors. Put them away outside down the road so no one can like see what's happening right on the set. And I kind of turned it into something more intimate. And that's how I kind of found a way to work within that kind of system from that place.
Well, so I mean, just pausing on looking, you know, you had two seasons. Some of the things I've seen that you have talked about in context of looking is, I guess I would say, the impossibility of pleasing an audience who want. Maybe it's because it's an audience that hasn't been that represented, and it's like, okay, this is my turn to be represented, and it better be me.
Yeah, I think it was a huge kind of burden, and I think we always knew going into it that that would be the case. I think when you make a film, it's kind of easier because you're just making a film and then it gets shown. Something on HBO, the world's most famous cable channel, it's expected to like represent people and represent everybody. And of course, you know, as you say, it's an impossible thing to do, is to represent a whole community. And it was never my intention to do that. So it was interesting to see, you know, the people that loved it, the people that didn't love it, you know, the people that said it didn't represent them as if it should have represented them. And it's very complex because I understand the desire to be represented on screen. But of course, one TV show cannot do that. And also, I understand my style of filmmaking is also not for everybody. So I always knew it was going to have its challenges, and HBO were very supportive, and it was sad that we couldn't go on, but they gave us like a movie to wrap it up, which we've just shot. So I feel like in the end, I've managed to bring the stories to the place I wanted to bring them to.
Did you feel that they were, you know, marketed it as much as needed to be marketed, or does nobody ever feel that?
Well, I mean, I actually am almost convinced that it was probably marketed too much in such a strange sense.
Oh, really?
Even though it probably was still their lowest, you know, marketed thing. It's it's like you market something as the show for gay people. It comes in with certain expectations. I get that it was such a tricky show to market. It's like, is this for gay people? Is it for everybody? How do you market to everybody? It's a very, very tricky thing. But, you know, the internet nowadays has a conclusion on something even like just after watching a trailer. So it gets,
right.
I think it's very complicated for a lot of filmmakers and TV, you know, people.
So when you moved on to 45 years, did you have a conscious thought like gay, maybe straight now? Not that you were thinking of changing your orientations, but that maybe you should do something not to be categorized as a gay filmmaker.
I mean, maybe a little bit, but at the same time, I made 45 years in between seasons 1 and 2 of Looking, so it was in the middle of that. But I'd actually had started the script like just after I finished making Weekend. And, you know, I was really loved the idea of this story and this script, like before I was even known essentially as a gay filmmaker. So it kind of preceded that. So in many ways, it's felt completely natural to me that I would tell this story. Like it makes sense to me in terms of thematically what I'm interested in and, you know, the kind of films I want to make. So it's almost like it's more surprising for other people. They very much expect you to stick with what you're known for. It's like, oh, so you're not going to make them gay? And I'm like, no, it's not everything about me is about my sexuality. You know, I have, you know, there are other things I'm interested in.
Right. There's more to life than one thing always.
Exactly.
So you came across, was it a short story, a very short story, right, by David Constantine?
Yeah, I came across that while I was editing Weekend, and I just loved the kind of the central idea of the story. And it took some adaptation a little bit because it's quite a short story, and I changed the perspective to being the woman's perspective rather than in the story that is mainly told from the male perspective. Lowered the ages a bit, changed a few things, added the party.
I guess it directs the action as it's all going toward this party from the beginning.
Yeah, I saw it as a kind of ticking time bomb, just a bit quiet, ticking time
raises
bomb.
Raises the stakes a bit, like, yeah. Oh, the party.
Exactly, gives it like a kind of forward momentum.
Coming up after a short break, Haig tells us why he doesn't believe in rehearsals. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer and director Andrew Haig. His new movie, 45 Years, is in theaters now. In the film, Tom Courtney and Charlotte Rampling play long-married couple Jeff and Kate, whose solid relationship is shaken when Jeff learns that the body of his long-dead girlfriend has been discovered in the Alps, frozen and preserved in time. The news sends Jeff into a tailspin, leaving Kate at a loss for how to respond.
Because these glaciers, they're melting a lot more than people imagined. The water is just not coming down.
It's got to go somewhere.
You know, it's saturating into the rock beneath and just building up and up and up.
Like a dam.
Like a dam, as if it's waiting.
Andrew Haig's first film, Weekends, starred little-known actors and almost didn't get funded. But when it met with success, finding financing and landing big-name talent for the next project became a lot easier.
I basically went to all the people that didn't fund Weekend, and I said, you know, you didn't fund my last film. Do you want to fund this film? And they were like, look, we're sorry we said no last time, so yes, we'll put you in development.
So you get your money to make, and I'm sure your budget was pretty modest on 45 years. You didn't have a ton of locations.
No.
But Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtney, icons of the British screen, right? Did you think of them when you were writing, or did you look for them later?
I look for them later. Like, I don't like to write with people in mind, just because you never know what's going to happen. You don't know who's going to say yes and who's going to say no. But then very quickly we approached Charlotte first, because I wanted to cast the female lead first, and then Tom very quickly afterwards. Luckily we had the money in place anyway, which was great.
Wasn't one of those, if you get this,
yeah,
then you get that. Yeah.
And Film 4 and the BFI in England were very supportive of like us choosing who we wanted to choose and all that kind of thing. It wasn't even about what's commercial or not commercial.
Wow, that's a luxury.
Which is a luxury. And I think it's within the budget level that we were shooting at.
Mm-hmm. I mean, were they familiar with your work? Did you have to send them?
I sent them both Weekend and Charlotte, you know, they watched it. And then, yeah, I think for someone like Charlotte, for example, she absolutely needs to know what the director is like. And she wants to talk to you as a director and find out, you know, what your intentions are and how you feel about the script and whatever. So she has to do that. Otherwise, I don't think she would ever do a film. It's so important to her. Tom very much was based on the script. He really loved the script. He hadn't watched Weekend. I still don't think he's actually watched it. But he loved the script and wanted to like do it from that basis. So I think different actors obviously work in different ways, either the writing or the directing.
So when you had to meet with Charlotte Rampling, did you sort of say, well, I better study up on her and figure out the right note? I assume you had to have a very important meeting with her where you were going to either sell yourself as a possibility or blow it.
Well, the weird thing was, I was in LA editing Looking, and she just called me up. We had a chat for half an hour, and she just asked me a bunch of questions, and we talked a little bit, and then she said, yeah, I'd love to do the film. And that was like it. And then I spent like 3 days with her, a few months before we started shooting. I went to see her in Paris, and we just like spent a few days together talking about things, talking about certain elements of the script, backstory things.
And is this to help her or to help you?
I think it's both of us. For me, the most important thing is that you develop a connection with your actor. Like, that's the key to me, that they understand you and you understand them, so that when you start shooting, you don't have to say too much, because you can look at that person, you can understand them, and you can know what help they need or when you should just like back off and let them do what they want to do. And so it's just about us like trusting each other in that moment. It was the same for Tom. And then I think once you've got that, then it's, you know, it's everything's easy.
The chemistry between the two of them is so imperative to this film. So I don't know whether you felt like they had to meet before.
Yeah, they'd never worked together, but we met for like a morning and we read through the script, and then that was it. We didn't do any rehearsal. We did nothing. You know, I think they know as actors that it's vital that the audience believes they've been together. So they bring that to their performances. You know, in the script, there's little things to like show that these are a couple that do love each other and have had a life together. And so we didn't. I'm not a big fan of rehearsals. Charlotte doesn't like to rehearse.
You feel it spoils the spontaneity of the performance?
I think it just, I don't know what it does. It always feels like if you get something amazing in the audition, I think it's very hard to achieve it again. And then also it can create some fear if you're doing like, sorry, rehearsals, you think like, oh, I'm not sure that this is working. But of course, you're in some like room in a local community theatre sitting around chairs, like trying to go through the script. It doesn't work for me. So I like to be in the location, in the environment, block it, camera rehearsal, and then just like shoot and see what happens.
Boom, shoot it. So we weekend premiered at South by Southwest. Mm. And then now you are doing this at Berlin.
Yes.
As well as Telluride in Toronto. That's quite a change from film to film.
Yeah, it was. Berlin was incredible because, you know, that was last February now, and it's so big, Berlin, as a festival, and we were in the main competition. So we were on, like, I think the second night, and it's in the massive, incredible theatre with, like, 1,500 people, and it's also red carpety, and it was an incredible experience. Like, it's a small film, and suddenly we're there, like, watching it with an audience of, you know, a packed cinema on like the night. People seem to like it, and they both won Silver Bears for their acting there.
Fantastic.
And it kind of like changed everything for the film. It got picked up for distribution out of Berlin. I think the deal was done like before we left, like a week later.
This is the IFC deal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. IFC had done Weekend too.
Right.
So that kind of helped because I knew I liked them a lot, and I felt like they did such a good job with the Weekend, and I like to feel comfortable in those environments. And there were some other offers by equally good people who I really liked and had lovely conversations with. So it's very hard to make those decisions about who to go with. And
not just at dollars and cents.
And not just at dollars, because pretty much all the dollars were about the same that everyone was offering. So it was hard to try and make the choice. And in the end, me and the producer liked the idea of going with someone that we had worked with before.
You danced with the one who brought you.
Yeah, exactly. There was a certain amount of like, you know, they helped my career a lot in distributing Weekend and doing a good job of that. So, yeah.
So at this point, you've sort of got this thing going and Looking doesn't get another season. So that's a mix, I suppose. Or were you really ready to move on? I don't know.
It's kind of, I didn't necessarily want to be doing Looking for the next 10 years of my life because it takes a lot of work. But I loved working with all the guys and the crew and the cast. It's been the same from the beginning, same crew each year. You know, I would have been really sad if I didn't get to finish it at all. And so now really doing a movie has helped that process because we've got to finish it. But also I think even going in, I always knew that it was going to be an uphill battle. It's not as if I thought, hey, we're going to get 7 seasons and it's going to,
right.
Like I was aware of what the show was. And, you know, I was kind of amazed that HBO gave it a shot to start with. It's not the biggest seller of a show.
So you were able to kind of wrap up Looking with this film.
Yes. Yeah, that was nice. It was just nice to be able to end it in a place that I felt good about. And it would have been nice to have a third season to, like, tell those stories over a longer period of time. And it's turning a half-hour TV show into a movie is a challenge because you get used to watching something within a half-hour format and then suddenly it's within an hour and a half.
I have all of this time now.
Yeah, but you don't want it to be just like 3 episodes stuck together. So
right.
You have to change the rhythm of what that movie is. So it's been a challenge, but I'm editing at the moment, so we'll see how it goes.
Do you know what your next project is?
Yeah, I've got a project that's hopefully coming together and shooting in the summer in America.
Film.
So it's a film project.
You would figure out who's distributing it later? Would you go the indie circuit?
I think it's all with those are all the kind of negotiations and the conversations that we're having at the moment. And it's a different, because it's slightly bigger budget, it opens up obviously a whole different
the slippery
kind of
slope.
Can of worms. But it's not dramatically different budget, so I don't feel like I'm selling my soul for the sake of anything. We'll see.
You've
how
been
that
a
goes.
Bit charmed coming off the blocks here, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, every time something goes right, I'm always I think maybe British people are quite pessimistic by nature, so I'm like, always waiting for it to become a disaster.
Right.
And I'm also aware that, you know, most careers as a filmmaker do not last forever. They just don't. We like to pretend they do, but they don't. It becomes increasingly hard to make films. If one film isn't successful, it becomes increasingly, unless you're one of those very, very lucky few. So I kind of want to make the most of it with the choices I make. So I don't want to make a film if I don't think it's worth it, or if it's really going to be something I really care about. So I'm aware that it might not last for like 30 years, my career. So I'm going to like take advantage of it while I can and stick to what it is that I want to do.
Andrew Haig is the director and writer of 45 Years. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's been great being here.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Grant Buckerfield. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.